Recorder is on. You're on.
Okay. So I did my paper on the AIA, and I really tried to center around some of the justifications that Congress might have had in passing each of the major changes. As you guys saw from my paper, I had it broken down as for each major change and then the four different phases that it went into effect. So one was immediate phases, two, 10 days after, 1 year, and 18 months. So I passed out a little outline, essentially, to try to guide the conversation. Essentially, each one is just essentially the introduction and then the major changes that happen immediately, the major changes happen after that, so on and so forth. So what I really wanted to get from you guys was your input as to things that I could possibly add, other things that I could think about, all of that kind of stuff. So in the introduction, one of the major claims that I made was how the AIA is probably the most major development in the United States patent system since its inception. My justification based on that was the fact that the 1952 Patent Act was largely just a codification of previously existing case law. Now, on that note, I do realize that Section 103, the obvious section, the non-obvious section, wasn't really part of case law. There was more of a split, and they snuck it in there, as we read in the Boulder and Levine book. Now, should I go into more detail as to the non-obvious section, or did the, feel so?
I think the new stuff.
Okay, so the new stuff is the
Your claim is a neat way of starting it, but it's not really.
That was more the purpose of the introduction. So if we move now to phase one, we have the patents related to taxes and human organisms. So as it said in the paper, it's completely unpatentable subject matter now. Any patent related to a human organism or any patent related to taxes is out. The justification behind that was that tax patents, there was a large influx in tax patents because of the business method patents. The State Street case essentially said that business method patents were okay. This case was in 2008. And so as you would assume, if a three-year average in terms of when patents are granted after they're filed, that means in 2011 there was a huge amount of business method patents and a huge influx on patents that were then causing a big gum up in the system, some of which were tax-related patents. So the AIA sought to change that. They basically said, don't worry about tax-related patents. So methods of paying less for your taxes, methods of paying less, anything to do with taxes, those are out. And then human organisms.
So why that particular thing out?
Why are taxes out?
Yeah, you could have cut the influx by raising the fees, by cutting anything else up. What's special about taxes?
What was special about taxes is that everybody should probably be able. I'm assuming the justification, which I can go, that could be one of the things that I talk about more, is everybody should be able to take advantage of whatever tax implications
but
they can.
But don't see the inconsistency between this and the whole justification of patents.
Right.
If you
come up with an innovation, you should be compensated for it.
If you believe in the theory of patents, mm-hmm. then the result of this will be to reduce people's ability to reduce their taxes, which you might say is the purpose because they want to collect more taxes.
Exactly.
If you believe Boulder and Levine, they've just shot themselves in the foot, mm-hmm. because if you believe Boulder and Levine, then patentability of these things resulted in fewer such things and less progress, and there will now be more progress. So it does seem to me that there's an odd puzzle, especially in the combination of that and human organisms. So you might
right.
plausibly say the government doesn't want us to be good at avoiding taxes, mm-hmm. but they do want us to be good at not dying.
Exactly.
So if they believe patents work, it makes sense to exclude tax methods but not to exclude human organisms.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't believe they work, it's the other way around. And that's why I found it a puzzling combination.
And it could have been on that same note that the government didn't want to put on a bad face about their patent system. Now they are essentially limiting the people that can claim certain tax advantages, and then they end up getting the benefit as for that law. You understand what I mean by that? If you were to allow business method tax patents, then people could go ahead and take advantage of that. It would then be limited, and then you would have to license a fee in order to take advantage of those patents. However, the ultimate benefactor in this whole thing is the government, because either you are stimulating the economy by paying the license fee and moving the money around, or you don't feel so if you're moving money around. Okay.
That would be a long discussion.
Okay.
I was there, the beneficiary of the government, that the government wants to collect taxes.
Yeah.
And therefore, if it believes that having this be patentable results in less use of it,
mm-hmm.
then it wants it
they don't increase their tax revenue.
If it believes that it results in more use of it than it wants less, it's unpatentable.
Okay. One?
You might want to model out kind of different numbers to figure out what the government might do. So, for example, if on average a certain patent tax, patentable tax system, takes $100 that was originally going to go to the government.
Right.
But ask for a $90 fee
for
its use, and the person's going to save $10. He's going to want to save that $10.
Exactly. He would still pay the fee in order to take advantage of it.
$90, and somebody else gets it. From the government's perspective, they and the taxpayer are the only two parties that are relevant. So they want that $90 to either the government or the taxpayer.
Yeah. Okay.
I was just curious, if you already have the patent, you get to keep it, right? Nothing gets invalidated.
They weren't clear on that in the AIA. I'll have to try to look up some cases as to exactly how that held. I don't remember if I discussed it in...
It sounds like it's just new stuff that would be subject. If it was like taxes...
Well, their wording specifically was by becoming unpatentable subject matter, it is per se being considered part of the prior art. So... And then you could probably argue, if you wanted to bring an invalidity contention, that now that all tax-related patents are now part of the prior art, they're no longer allowed. So if they consider it just the prior art, then they probably could bring an invalidity action to invalidate whatever patents had previously been granted.
Except the relevant thing is the prior art at the time the patent was granted or at the time when the invention was invented, and it was, since the act hadn't been passed at that time, it was the prior art then.
That would be the argument against it.
As to whether, and maybe this is obvious to other people, but it sounds to me, if it was business method patents or avoiding taxes, we're assuming that if they did grant patents that people would be paying more in taxes?
No, it wasn't that assumption. It was that you're going to be able to take advantage of the tax benefits. But if you do allow business method tax patents, then you're going to have to pay someone else in order to take advantage of that benefit.
Yeah, so at least my thinking is that people wouldn't want to pay that sort of extra fee to use that patent or maybe just avoid it altogether and maybe end up paying more taxes than they would have if they were able to just use these methods.
Can you rephrase the question so then I understand it a little bit better? Essentially what you're saying is some people might not pay the fee.
I just think that if it's... I was wondering what your thoughts were on whether if they were allowed to patent it, would it lead to more people paying more taxes or whether or not...
It probably wouldn't lead to anybody paying more taxes unless the license fee itself was higher than the tax savings. But then,
except that it's being unpatentable, which is my incentive to figure out a difficult but clever way of evading taxes.
That's a good point.
In order to get licensed. This is the point I was starting with.
Okay.
If you believe that patents do a good job of promoting innovation, then making it patentable results in fewer taxes because people think up more schemes. If you believe that patents retard innovation, which is the Bolger and Levine thesis, one of their theses, then making it unpatentable results in you paying less taxes because now people think up schemes and they spread around and everybody uses them. So I think it really does hinge on your view of the patent system, whether the government gains or loses by this.
Yeah, I also think it's difficult in the sense that the IRS or the government can change the tax laws.
And a further issue really is what your view is of ways of avoiding taxes. That is, one way of looking at it is to say, why should you spend all these resources just so the government can have less money? Another way is, well, the tax system is complicated because we don't want to tax everything. All right, if you imagine, for example, suppose you tax government, tax firms' revenue instead of their profit. That gives you a lot of very inefficient results if you think about it for a while. Because it means that anything where I can produce something for $10,000 and it costs an $8,000, I won't do it because after taxes I'll have less than $10,000, right? So if you say theory of the law is we're trying to set it up to give you the right incentives, then maybe these methods of avoiding tax are just ways of doing that better. You have to think, as it were, about whether you believe that tax avoidance is a trick which evades the function of the tax, or is a way of improving it, of saying, well, look, such and such really is an expense, and therefore shouldn't be included in tax avoidance. So anyway, it's complicated, but it's interesting.
Okay, so the next portion that I talked about was the human organisms. And does anybody have any comments as to the justifications behind human organisms? I mean, obviously,
figure out what kind of patents they're imagining.
I believe that it probably went into entail of the myriadogenetics case. And granted, it's a little different because you're taking something out of the body, you're changing it. So whether or not that is actually entailed or not, I really don't know. It was just, it's a blanket prohibition, and they didn't define.
How about if I patent a new form of surgery? Or if I patent a new way of making prosthetic shoulders or something, would that be covered as human organism?
I doubt that a prosthetic shoulder would be considered a human organism. Now, there's always the progression on how far do you get before something can then be considered a human organism. It definitely encompasses cloning of any kind. So, I mean, if you were to clone a human organism, then you cannot patent that cloning process, don't you feel?
You can't patent the cloning process.
Yeah.
What if you clone a complete human being without a brain or a brain stem?
Well, then is it a human organism or not? And that would have to be something up to the Supreme Court. So if everybody is good on that section, I'd move to the next section. Okay. The next section was inter partes reexamination. This was in effect prior to the passage of the AIA. It was essentially a third party could ask, instead of taking it through litigation, you could then take it to the USPTO and ask for it to be reexamined. All they changed with this was the initial burden that they must show, and the initial burden changed to a higher burden. So they essentially made it harder for you to bring an inter partes reexamination. And then, as I'll get to later, or as I alluded to later, this was actually completely eliminated from a option of review, and it got replaced with inter partes review, which kept the same burden, but was just, it was almost the same thing, just slightly different.
But now, it looks as though this reduces litigation before the patent is issued and increases litigation after the patent is issued. No.
Exactly. That was kind of the problem. And the reason why it was completely eliminated as an option and then changed to inter partes review was because they added in the portion of post-grant review. And post-grant review is designed to reduce litigation overall. So as it had set, when they changed the initial burden, you were essentially increasing the incentive to litigate after the patent was granted and not go through inter partes review because you had a stronger burden of showing. So with the implementation of post-grant review, it changed it slightly. Any comments on inter partes re-exam? Okay, best method. So the one thing that I want to say about best method is there was a string of cases that essentially said, you know, you shouldn't claim best method as a mode for invalidity. Now, this is saying that inequitable conduct is different than failure to actually allege the best mode of the operation of the patent.
What I found puzzling in your discussion was you seemed to be saying they had to reveal what they had to do under the old law was reveal the best mode that they were contemplating. Then suppose I think up something, I have a patent, I apply
Correct.
For a patent. There's some much better way of practicing which never occurred to me. Do I lose my patent? That's sitting there recording you.
Is this still on? I flashed.
So under the previous situation, it's still recording.
Okay.
Under the previous arrangement, am I wrong in thinking that it did not make it invalid if there was a better mode that I wasn't aware of?
Well, people would bring that in litigation to allege that you failed to actually bring about the best mode.
The best mode or the best mode that I was aware of?
You would allege the best mode that you were aware of. And then they would bring an invalidity contention.
And were they claiming that I had known of their mode or not?
They were claiming that that was not the best mode.
I don't think that disqualifies. If I correctly understand the law before, if there is a better mode that I don't know about and I'm not contemplating, I don't believe I'm required to disclose it. I can't because I don't know.
You would not be guilty of inequitable conduct because you weren't trying to defraud the patent office. Mm-hmm. However, you're held to an objective standard. So under the objective standard, they would say that a person of ordinary skill in the art would have known of this better mode. And this person of the ordinary skill in the art would have said that this is the best mode. Mm. So you are a subjective standard and is held to an objective standard.
And that's the old.
Yeah, exactly. And the courts essentially said because of the hindsight problems that it presented, we're just not going to consider it anymore. And the hindsight problems were when you came out with an invention and then it took a different form of its own over time, people would automatically assume that, oh yeah, you know, this invention was supposed to go to this, and there was a potential bias based on future knowledge. So it was very hard to back set the date. And they still left into effect the inequitable conduct provisions, and that's when you purposely, subjectively defraud the patent office, and you don't actually make an objective violation. So, any questions on best mode? Essentially, all that they did was they just further clarified previous court holdings that said, yes, you can't use best mode in the invalidity contention.
So the previous court holdings, and it's got the same thing you were saying about the earlier act, and it's not really anything new at all.
It's not really anything new. It's more of just a codification, and just to clarify, you can no longer do that. It went through circuit by circuit of the best mode, so some circuits, I believe, were undecided, and so they went ahead and cleared up the entire thing. So the next thing was limitations on joinder. I had a real problem with the limitation on joinder provision of the AIA. Essentially, it said that now if you have one patent and multiple defendants infringe upon the same patent, that doesn't actually qualify with the rules of federal civil procedure in the same transaction of an occurrence. Just because it was the same patent and multiple defendants are infringing that patent, you cannot sue them as like a class action, quote unquote. So the plaintiff cannot sue multiple defendants just because they all infringe the same patent. So that was a limitation on joinder. I didn't really understand why they wanted to break apart the joinder provision and enforce more lawsuits. Because if you take more lawsuits, for example, you're going to take your patent, you're going to litigate against defendant one, you're going to go all the way through claim construction. That is probably going to get appealed because it always gets appealed to the Federal Circuit if it's a valuable case. And claim construction, the trial court's decision on claim construction, doesn't matter when it comes to Federal Circuit review. They don't give any deference to it. So you completely go into a brand new claim construction holding. So now you have an opinion from the Federal Circuit, and that opinion is somewhat binding on the next defendant number two. So you're having a very hard time litigating. So defendant number two is now sort of, it's more influential, it's not binding. But defendant number two is now sort of prejudiced because of the litigation that you did with defendant number one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to argue, not the other side, but an alternative way of looking at it, though, is because we have non-mutual collateral estoppel,
correct.
We with patents, it would actually discourage frivolous lawsuit because if you are bringing, it basically gives people who are allegedly violating patents more of a chance to challenge the invalidity, and if just one of them gets a trial court to decide that the patent is invalid, then it's invalid for all the other defendants. So really it kind of gives potential violators an advantage because they can litigate the validity of a patent 100 times and only have to win their case once, whereas a patent holder has to win it for every single individual once. So they...
Wait a minute. Explain this to me. Not much.
There are ten
people who I claim have violated my patent. I sue the first one and I win. I sue the second one and I win. I sue the third one and I lose. Now what happens?
Your patent is invalid against all other defendants.
So including the first two I won against?
No, because they don't have the right. I don't think they have the right to challenge the later hearing. But any subsequent defendants would have the automatic defense of, well, it's invalid. They're collaterally stopped from arguing that the patent is valid after that point in time. So it kind of gives violators an advantage by not having the cases, or alleged violators, an advantage and more opportunity to challenge the patent without, I know, it's kind of a weird...
It's very strange why they would do that. Now, as I noted in the paper, the defendants can consent to being sued all at once. I don't know why they would consent. I've put in some possible justifications that they get to share discovery costs or they get to share certain court fees, but it's not a huge incentive. I mean, to me, if I was defendant number 10 I would want everybody else to go ahead and try to knock that patent down before I finally got to try to knock it down. So it's like you have to keep on proving the same thing over and over again. It seems a little, you know, like, it seems like economic waste. You're essentially hiring an attorney, you're going through the whole thing, and then you're going to go through it again and again and again and again. You have a lot of problems with inconsistent rulings.
Yeah, and it's not only an inefficient use of the courts, that it's going to be burdening the courts. There's another provision in AIA that you didn't mention, but I think you could, might want to fold into this section, possibly,
okay.
Which 1454, 28 U.S. Code 1454 is the thing that basically it's saying that, because you know how it used to be under, if anyone had, you had to, okay, well, pleaded complaint rules, you had to have a patent issue on the face of the original complaint, and
right.
The federal courts are not granted jurisdiction if the there was a patent question on a counterclaim or a breach of the defense. So they actually put a provision in the American Events Act, which is now 1454, and it says that if either party raises a patent issue, if either party raises a patent issue, then you can remove jurisdiction to the federal court. So
correct.
Actually pulling cases that normally would have been held in state courts where there was they're on state law, but there may be an issue of a patent, like a licensing agreement or like a contract.
Correct. Okay.
That could potentially involve patent validity. And they're pulling all of those cases into federal court. Potentially pulling all those cases.
So it's a removal statute that essentially allows you to directly remove the federal court.
Yeah, it expands the amount. It basically expands federal jurisdiction of the courts to involve cases that would involve patents or copyright, but it doesn't appear on the face of a lawsuit, if that makes any sense. So basically,
okay.
Yeah. So like if I say Jake is infringing our licensing agreement, he's like, well, your patent is invalid, so it's an invalid licensing agreement.
Got it.
Then
it's the second step of the claim,
yeah,
so he can go ahead and...
That usually would still be held in state court. It's efficient in that it's making all decisions about patent law and the patent precedent
in federal court.
Federal court, which is efficient, but it's also adding potentially more lawsuits to the federal court, so it slows down the overall court process. So I mean, it's kind of a, you can argue it both ways.
The entire AIA seemed to want to increase efficiency, decrease litigation costs, and it's more now we're going through repetitive lawsuits. There could be a possibility of inconsistent rulings. Et cetera, et cetera.
If by your account, though, going back where we've got the 10 different infringers, putative infringers, if the cases always get appealed, they're always going to get appealed up to the same appeals court, right?
Sorry?
Aren't they always going to get appealed to the court?
The federal circuit?
Yeah.
Yeah, all patent matters should be appealed.
So doesn't that mean that if I win my first case, that... Despite your collateral estoppel rule, if I win my first case, doesn't the second person say, well, there isn't any chance that I'm going to win, because if I win in the district court, he'll appeal, and we already know what
no.
the Federal Circuit thinks?
Well, because it's actually non-mutual collateral estoppel, because the only person who's stopped is the patent holder, because there's a different defendant, and since the different defendant wasn't a party, they are in no way...
I understand, but what I'm saying is not that he's stopped, but that he concludes that he's going to lose... Because he expects it will end up in the same court which has already given its verdict.
It could be have a strategic issue, but I mean, it's the problem is there just aren't that many cases that are accepted by the appellate court. Is,
mm-hmm.
is Federal Circuit by right, or is it by...
I'll look it up.
Okay, yeah, I'm not sure.
I thought everything except the Supreme Court was by right, but I could be wrong.
I could be wrong. I thought that the Federal Circuit wasn't, but I could be 100% wrong.
And is there different federal circuits for every jurisdiction?
No, it's just the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit has jurisdiction over all appeals
okay.
to the district courts coming out of patent. Just because it's similar to have one open. They used to have a bunch of circuits.
That was a big change back
yeah.
in the way when they created the AFC.
Yeah. The different circuits have their own ways of construing patent claims, and it was very, very messy and ugly.
Mm-hmm.
When they created the Federal Circuit in the 80s or something, it was they were going to have a...
With
the jurisdiction of all appeals.
Got it. Perfect. So there's nothing else. Let's go. Okay, so we are now entering phase two. All these changes took effect 10 days after the AIA was passed. The first change that I discussed was the prioritized patent examination.
This essentially is for a large increased fee. I believe I wrote the fee down. It was somewhere in the tune of $4,000 to $5,000. You could apply for a prioritized examination. This meant that usually your patent would end up granted within a one-year time period. That's essentially what the previous years have shown. If you apply for priority examination, you've generally been granted your patent within 1 year. There's a three-year average on granting a patent under the previous system. So under that three-year average, your 20-year monopoly is determined from the date of filing. So if it takes 3 years for you to get your patent, that means you only have a 17-year monopoly. Now, on that same note, if with your 1 year, if you were able to get it in 1 year, then you technically effectively have a 19-year monopoly. It's a 2-year bonus.
Your paper put it as if the main advantage was the longer coverage. But it seems to me that there's a second, possibly more important advantage, which is the faster coverage. If you imagine a patent which is going to be worthless in 6 years anyway,
exactly,
if something is going to be out, then it matters a lot whether I get it for 5 years or for 3 years, basically. So in a sense, I don't know enough about how common they are, but it seems to me that could easily be more important. What fraction of patents are still valuable 18 years later?
Exactly. And
do you know?
I really don't know. I mean, it's probably only a small percentage.
Related question, you described the $4,000 as a large fee. How much is normally spent on prosecuting a single patent?
I would have to look it up. It depends how many bumps in the road you hit.
Because in a sense, part of your analysis is this really a large fee which will discourage lots of people from doing it, or is it really a trivial addition to an already large cost, in which case it's just an extra revenue source, and everybody will be exploited, and if they're all exploited, unless they can hire some more examiners, it's just not going to work.
Exactly, and that is the ultimate problem. It's the tragedy of the commons problem. I mean, that's how you would generally describe it.
But
everyone pays the extra fee, and therefore they're not.
But are you assuming that the extra fee isn't used to buy more resources?
Well, it's not, because in 2011, the USPTO generated $90 million in profits. So they have plenty of extra resources that they could use to hire more examiners. And then that would ultimately bring down the three-year average into a two-year average, for example, if they just were working on a non-profit basis, which would be great. Everybody would take advantage. The incentive would go up. You wouldn't have to offer it at extra fees. So they're already making hand over fist, but their actual funding is determined by the government. So unless the government itself elects that all these priority examination fees will go directly to hiring more examiners, so then we don't have this problem, then you do have a problem. So it's all contingent upon the government actually taking action.
So how long has this been in existence?
This was 10 days after the AI was passed, so September 26, 2011.
So you ought to know whether at this point most or very few patent examinations pay the extra money and get these.
So far it's very few. It's under 10,000 of the entire whole, which there are a couple hundred thousand that apply for the waiver. Or there's a couple hundred thousand that apply for a patent every year. I believe under 10,000 have paid the extra fee.
Yeah, well, that suggests then that maybe it is significant.
Yeah.
But also, you put it in terms of whether you could afford to pay it.
I was more looking at the small inventor that has a great invention. The small inventor actually qualifies for reduced fees. He can get a patent for well under $1,000 because he's under the micro-entity status. There's these different statuses. You have a micro-entity, a small entity, and then a normal large entity, and they have classified exactly what these entities entail. Now, the small inventor that only has so many pending patents, I believe it's under 5, then he can go ahead and qualify for very reduced fees. The small entity is reduced, but not quite. I believe one is 60% of the normal fee, one is 80% of the normal fee, and one is 100% of the normal fee.
But it seems to me that what's more likely to go on is not the question of can you afford it, but is it worth it to you?
Is it worth
$4,000? You could pay $4,000, assuming you're not bankrupt from your law school fees. That it's not, you know, in sort of a modern society, it's not very often that that's really going to be a bar in terms of people not having the money. But
exactly.
It might well be a bar in the sense you say, well, you know, I've got these 17 neat ideas, and if I can get them for, you know, $1,000 a piece, it's worth it. $5,000 a piece is not. And then you might say it's a desirable thing, or it's at least desirable that we spend our resources on the important patents rather than the unimportant patents. And then the applicant himself is deciding which is which.
That makes sense. Anything else about priority exam?
It's worth noting, by the way, that this particular issue or tension shows up in a whole lot of other places, that when you suggest charging for something, one way people interpret that is you want the rich to have it and the poor not to have it. Mm-hmm. Another way of interpreting is you want people to whom it's important to have it and to whom it's unimportant not to have it. To some sense, both of them are happening, that the richer you are, the less important it has to be for you to be willing to spend money. But, yeah.
You're talking about the priority?
Yeah, I'm talking about the priority.
Okay.
I don't know. This is the thought that's popped into my mind.
I definitely don't know the statistics on patent trolls. I mean, I always was under the understanding that they purchased patents that were already in existence from bankrupt companies and got it for very cheap prices and then asserted the gray borders that, oh, this product is infringing, this product is infringing, and this product is infringing.
Okay.
That's always what I had understood.
Okay.
I don't know if it's true, but that's the standard story.
Yeah, I had always understood that that was a story and not that they were actually applying for patents themselves.
Okay.
And then I was always assumed that they had either had patents and sat on them until some sort of technology encompassed the patent, or the opposite of they purchased it from someone else. Okay, next, go ahead.
Well, I think against patent trolling is why they also did the limitations on trolling, or they were trying to limit patent.
I kind of thought that as well. I mean, you're going to increase the fees for the patent troll to bring the case. Now he can bring 20 cases instead of one case, if you know what I mean. So it works both ways. You're going to have an individual defendant for each one, and he could bring 20 cases at the same time.
He
has to pay 20 times more. However, I don't know exactly how his ability to settle each case out, because the defendants are colluding with one another. So
he could bring the first case, win it, and then use that as leverage to get the others to all settle.
Yeah. So it kind of works both ways. I mean, he could bring 20 cases, and he could just pick one of them that wants to settle. That money would then cover the increased fees, and then it all worked out just fine. When you sue 20 defendants at one time, they all have their own attorneys talking to each other, and they're all saying, oh, this case is crap, let's go ahead and they can share the fees, it's not as expensive for them. And that's probably why they can consent to joinder rather than it being barred altogether. Yes?
I read also that the joinder thing was about venue. Because before...
I had read something about that, too, so go ahead.
You sue somebody and then join a bunch of people and sort of force them to come to that venue.
I had read something about that before as a justification against forum shopping.
Yeah, it was a gamesmanship thing that they were concerned about.
The reason why I didn't discuss that was you could still file 20 different lawsuits in the Eastern District of Texas, or you could file one lawsuit in the Eastern District of Texas and then join everybody. It seemed like the same thing. Do you know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, it seems like whether...
As long as those people are infringing in Texas. If they're infringing in Maryland,
okay.
You can't sue them in Texas and force them to file.
So what happened, I'm curious, in the joinder case, you join 10 firms. Who gets to decide what their defense strategy is?
Well, that's the problem, because everybody tries to decide what the defense strategy is. There's been attorneys that, you know, they'll present an argument in front of the judge.
Who chooses the attorney? You join the 10 of us to defend our 10 supposed infringements of your patent, and I say I want so-and-so to be our attorney, and you say you want so-and-so, what determines it?
That's exactly the problem, is everyone has to determine it upon their own, or each individual attorney for each individual client needs to be heard, and it gets a little confusing. So that would be probably one of the main justifications that I'll include now, is the litigation strategy problems that it eliminates. Because if you limit joinder, then everybody can then pick their own litigation. You have possibility of inconsistent rulings, but then now you can actually pick your own litigation strategy, and there's no possibility of confusion between the one. I had heard of a story once that the attorney stepped up in front of the judge, and then he made an argument, and then the judge, you know, are you really making this argument? Because it seemed like a very bad argument. And then his response was, well, not all of us are making this argument, Your Honor. I mean, some of us feel another way, but this is the first one that I'm throwing out there. So the litigation strategy issues, that would probably be a great one to go ahead and discuss in terms of a justification. We were just about to move to the increased fees. If anybody... Okay. Increased fees. So they put a 15% increase on all fees effective 10 days after the passage. and then they gave a broad fee-setting authority to the director of the USPTO. After that, I believe he had fee-setting authority for a blankier time period. I want to say 8 up until 2020, but I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to look it up. The increased fees, I talked about the justifications behind that. Do you guys have any other justifications behind increased fees? I mean, there was no telling that the first fee was actually too low or too high, but the increased fees might bring it up to normal. If it was too low, that means that the incentive then to file a patent was then, I guess you would say, subsidized.
What struck me is that the question is, what things don't you want to grant patents to? And it's tempting to say things that aren't very important. But then the counter-argument is, well, it's not very important, then the disadvantage of not being able to do it without paying for the patent also isn't very large.
Exactly.
So an argument one could make is that when I get a patent on something, I impose two different costs on the rest of the world. One of them is the standard deadweight burden, you're going to have to license it from me, et cetera, et cetera. The other is that I make it a little bit harder for everybody else in the world to find out whether he's infringing me when he invents something.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say that by increasing the total body of patents by one, I'm imposing a cost that doesn't depend on how important my patent is. And consequently, it's not worth imposing that cost unless the patent is important enough, and that therefore the fee is going to discourage people who have patents that are worth something but not very much.
One thing that I thought of.
How big is the fee?
It was 15% increase among whatever the fees were before.
And range of fees before.
I'd have to look it up. It depended on which classification you fell into.
I was then thinking about whether your $4,000 was or wasn't a large increase.
Mm-hmm. It's the fees for a large entity is under $4,000. I want to say it's closer to 2, and then for a large entity it's about 1, and for a micro it's about 5. But those numbers are very rough. I'd have to look it up. Another possible justification that I didn't discuss in the paper that I was going to run by you guys is it probably increased fees would discourage speculation. So if you have a invention that is not yet a good invention, but it could be in the future, now you won't. Your incentive to actually file and wait is a little bit less. It discourages gambling on, I hope that this becomes a great innovation at some point.
But isn't that really the same point as it discourages low-value inventions?
It's just a low-value invention, high-value rather than because you're. Anything else? Nope. Okay, phase 3, 1 year after the AIA was passed. The first thing that I discussed was the modification of the oath/the declaration requirement. This essentially allowed assignees or other people that had interest in the patent to prosecute the patents upon the inventor's behalf. Previously, the inventor had to sign an oath or affirmation stating that it was essentially the under penalty of perjury requirement that every inventor had to sign. Now, if you cannot get that signature from the inventor, there's ways to easily get around it based on how the AIA changed it, and also there are other ways for you to prosecute the patent completely upon the inventor's behalf. So now, depending if you're going to assign it to your law firm or assign it to anything like that, you could actually have the law firm just do the whole thing. You don't have to do anything. Which, before, you didn't really have to do much anyway. You just had to sign something. Anything on that? Just easier to prosecute a patent. That was about all that I had on that one. Third-party submission of prior art. Prior to the AIA, third parties weren't allowed to submit prior art to the USPTO. This was essentially under the premise that the USPTO knew how to do their job. They would find everything. However, as everybody knows, you know, you can always miss something at some point. But they also didn't want to be swamped with large submissions of third-party prior art. They were completely irrelevant that they had to then go over. So it might have been they wanted to conserve resources and operate more efficiently rather than having to worry about the possibility that they might miss something. So the rule then is now third parties are allowed to submit prior art, which, I mean, how do you guys feel about that? I mean,
you raised the problem that if I get expedited passage, you're not allowed to submit prior art because it will have issued before you're allowed to see it.
As the rule is right now, if you apply for priority examination and the patent is granted within 12 months, the normal publication timeline is only 18 months. So your patent will be granted, it will be reviewed, granted, and determined whether or not valid or not valid within a 12-month time period, which it hadn't even been published to the public yet, so then therefore no third party could submit prior.
So one thing I had wondered is why the expedited examination didn't include an expedited publication.
That I don't know. It probably should have. I mean, it makes more sense that if you're going to expedite within 6 months, then they might have assumed also that if you are one of the people that is expediting it, they also want to be able to grant it as fastly as possible and most efficiently as possible. So therefore, if you do allow third-party submission of prior art, it might then slow down the process overall because you have, you know, 100 different parties submitting the same prior art to you.
I'd also wondered whether anybody had tried to, as it were, create repositories of prior art in order to prevent the patenting of things they didn't want patented. Because some years ago, some of the nanotech people were making the proposal. In fact, they wanted us to be involved, as the sanitary involved, so we didn't, unfortunately, maybe. And their idea was basically that nanotech was a new technology, that there had been a problem, a lot of people thought, in computer software, with people patenting things that really weren't novel, that everybody knew how to do, but the judge didn't know how to do it. And so their idea was to establish an online data bank, as it were, where anybody who had any nanotech invention he didn't want to patent would put it up on the data bank, and then when someone tried to patent it 5 years later, you'd have a place to point at who it wasn't. And I wondered, it's not that who would do it, because you'd need, there's sort of a public good kind of problem, but you could imagine if you have some industry where people are seriously worried about patenting of non-novel things,
mm-hmm.
that they could themselves create a data bank, design it in a way to make it easily searchable, and then just say to the PTO, by the way, we've just done some helpful work for you. If your patent is in this characteristic, in this area, here's where to look. Mm-hmm. Has anybody tried doing that, do you know?
Besides your nanotech example, I have no idea.
If any of you are entrepreneurial inclined, you might see if you could find professional associations that would like to hire you to do it.
There is one company now. Their name eludes me at this point. But essentially, they because of the AIA that came into existence, and it is a company that you put out a bounty on prior art, essentially. Is after something's published, if you can come up with any prior art on this thing, say, for example, it's a patent that will probably hurt Microsoft in some way. Microsoft might hand this company $5,000 for the bounty. Then it goes out to the general public. Whoever can come up with the best prior art reference gets the $5,000. And then that company then will submit on behalf of the third party to the USPTO as to why.
Has the PTO ever thought about doing that? That is, the present situation is one in which the only incentive to submit prior art
is if it hurts your interests.
Is it hurts you if patent hurts you. But there could be lots of people whom that isn't true. So one wonders if maybe the PTO should have a bounty system where they say, you know, at some stage in the process, they say, we think we're going to give a patent to this. If anybody can prove to us that we shouldn't, we'll give them $5,000. Would that be a workable system?
Like I said before, you'd probably have the problem of people not submitting totally relevant prior art.
Well, you could charge for it. You could say that in order to enter this competition, you've got to pay us $100.
Okay, that would probably work then.
Anyway, think about it. It just strikes me as an interesting possibility.
So, next one. Go ahead.
I can send you a link on this, but for one of my research or my topics, they
sure.
were talking about how kind of like generating that database to make sure that we're not losing anything.
Yeah.
Losing any, I guess, thing that was originally wanted to be contributed to the Commons. But I'll send you a link. There's a Harvard
Law Review. Article. Okay, we'll talk after class.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Anything else? No? Supplemental examination. So supplemental examination is a process that you can go through if you're a patent holder. If a new piece of prior art comes to life after you've been granted the patent, you can then take it to the USPTO, say, look, there's this new piece of prior art. Does it invalidate my patent, yes or no? And if there was some sort of proof of inequitable conduct on your behalf, then you could also take it to the USPTO, say, look, I know we, you know, behaved inequitably, but would this new piece have invalidated the patent? And at least with the inequitable conduct example, that would probably be, you know, an employee buried it without the company knowing or something along those lines, or the lawyer acted badly through no fault of the company's behalf. I doubt that it would come up with whoever signed the under penalty of perjury would say, yeah, I know we signed this thing saying that we could go to jail, but, you know, we didn't actually submit this thing to you. The supplemental examination thing is great to eliminate speculation. Essentially, you can decide whether or not your patent is valid and enforceable under anything that might come up, and then you don't have to litigate it. You just submit it back to the USPTO, and the USPTO tells you, yes, it's good under this piece of prior art. It takes away a lot of the litigation costs and everything along those lines of litigating a patent based on a new piece of prior art. And one thing about inequitable conduct that I discussed in the supplemental examination is how it can affect your entire patent portfolio. Go ahead.
I just reread the sentence to make sure I haven't missed it, but does this supplemental examination, is it binding on the court? So if the PTO says, well, this isn't something that would justify, would invalidate your patent on the basis of X, Y, and Z, whatever they refer to the...
I believe, yes, it is. In,
so it's actually binding on the court, so
yes.
There would be no longer...
And the whole purpose, I mean, the problem is if you have a patent and it's questionable, if you submit it to the USPTO and they go, yeah, you lost, you now don't have a patent.
Yeah.
Which you could have licensed it under, for a license fee under that of what litigation costs would have, you know, ensued. And then more than likely people would have licensed it from you. You would have got some sort of fee from the patent. However, because of that speculation, you don't really know if it's valid or not. It might be worth a bunch of money. But then, you know, the only thing that you can license it for, so then nobody sues you about it, it's much, much less than it's worth.
Well, but my question was more, if I think there's something that could potentially invalidate my patent, and I bring it to the PTO, and the PTO says, no, that doesn't invalidate your patent.
You're good. Then.
But my question is, does that mean that someone who I'm claiming is infringing my patent can no longer challenge it on that basis, can no longer say, well, there was improper behavior in the application process? PTO has said...
Well, I'll pose your question with a question. Under that, if the PTO says that they examined this piece of prior art in granting the patent, and then someone brings a complete invalidity action based on that piece of prior art in the federal court doesn't normally second-guess the USPTO, correct? USPTO has...
They have the right to, if they...
Do, they have the right to?
They do have... My understanding, which could be wrong, I'm not... my understanding is that they do have the ability to re-examine the prior art that was brought to the exam by the PTO. The reason I'm saying I think that's possible is purely because in the patent litigation class I took last year,
correct,
our case file included a letter to the PTO, and the PTO specifically said we looked at these five patents. And then we had those five patents, and we were actually claiming that based off of the prior art, it shouldn't have been granted. So that we were actually asking the court to challenge what the PTO had determined in their initial examinations.
So you were challenging the USPTO's assertion. Were you doing it based upon a claim construction? Like, were you arguing that the claims are broader than this, therefore it falls within this prior art instead of narrower?
Basically, we were saying that the patent examiner was wrong in granting the patent on the basis of prior art that was before the examiner at the time they determined it was patentable.
Okay. I will look it up if the court can overrule the USPTO's decision upon supplemental.
It occurs to me there's an interesting possible effect of this rule. I'm not sure how useful it is. But suppose that I'm a potential infringer, and I say, I think the following prior art that's now come to light makes your patent invalid.
Correct.
And should I gamble on it? Well, I say, if I was wrong, they would have gone back to the PTO to get a reexamination to clear it up. The fact that they didn't is evidence that really it is shaky and therefore I should infringe. So if you think of a sort of mechanism, if you think of the general issue of mechanisms by which you get people to reveal private information, in a sense, and one way you do it is you say you have the opportunity to do X and we observe whether you do X or don't do X. So that might, I'm not sure how much that gets you, but it might be an interesting way of thinking about this sort of thing.
Got it. And another justification that I discussed in the paper was the 4% to 40% increase in invalidity contingents based on inequitable conduct. That was within the years of, it was not a very long time period up until currently.
This is from 4% of all what?
4% of all invalidity contingents when you would litigate a patent and they would say your patent is invalid. They would only assert that 4% of the time, and then that increased to 40%, and I'm looking for the dates right now. And, well, if I find them in a second, then I'll talk about it. So the supplemental examination basically takes a lot of the teeth out of that, because as I was trying to say, inequitable conduct can invalidate your entire patent portfolio if you have a patent based on a claim. So one patent's granted, and then you have essentially derivative patents based upon that same part of that claim, and you continue to get patent after patent after patent after patent. If this claim is found invalid, all of the other claims are then essentially invalid as well. All the other patents are essentially invalid as well. So you had inequitable conduct is had a lot of punitive effects, essentially. And this takes a lot of the teeth out of that. So should we go to post-grant review? Okay, post-grant review is brand new. It's essentially, if you talk to IP litigators, they'll tell you two different things. Post-grant review, when you read it, is essentially a replacement for litigation. You don't have to litigate the patent. You can just take it towards post-grant review if it's within 9 months of the patent being granted. Now, IP litigators say there's no point to do post-grant review because of the estoppel problems and because the judge is so... they don't like that the judge is very sophisticated. A lot of times IP litigators like to litigate in front of a jury where they convince the jury one way or the other, because the lay jury, you know, they don't know anything about electrical engineering. So you take the concepts down to as simple as possible and you say, well, under this simple concept, would I be able to make a very good argument? So it depends who you talk to. Post-grant review, you essentially can bring an invalidity contention, same as you can in litigation. One thing about my my paper that I read over and I realized that I included on accident, is I included Section 112 as one of the reasons why you can bring an invalidity contention. That's actually the best mode requirement. That's not supposed to be in there. I'm going to delete that when I can. Any questions on post-grant review? Go ahead.
Oh, maybe it's actually, I was going to ask more like specific examples of like when and what the advantages and disadvantages would be of a post-grant review versus an inter partes review, but you have
inter partes review is you have a lot less grounds that you can assert invalidity on. You are limited to, I didn't go over it in my outline, but I have another paper. Inter partes review, you're limited to section 102 and 103. So you're limited to, I believe 102 is novelty and 103 is non-obviousness. Whereas post-grant review, you're allowed to bring novelty, obviousness, lack of enablement, indefiniteness, lack of proper written description. It's essentially, I don't know why you would bring an inter partes review unless you really felt you had a slam dunk case. And if you just felt that it would be cheaper than litigation itself. Because if you bring it into litigation, you can throw a lot more things at the wall. Does that make sense?
So what about the first to file versus first to invent? That's one where we've been different from the rest of the world for a long time.
Now, exactly. First to file versus first to invent is the it's probably the biggest change in association with the AIA. Previously, first to invent is you thought of your invention, you started writing down some notes, it was embodied in some way, and then from that point on, you had, I believe it was a 12-month time period, or no, you had reasonable time so as you did not abandon the invention. And as long as you did not abandon the invention, you proceeded with reasonable and best efforts, you could then be a patent holder even though somebody else filed first. And there was two problems with that. One, it was very hard to prove. And, you know, you would have very vague evidence that says, oh, yeah, this little note right here, I mean, you essentially did claim construction based on when you felt that you invented it. When I said this right here, that meant that I really invented this huge embodiment at that point. So it was a hard time right then, and then you also have the problem of swearing back behind prior art. So if you, it was incentive to lie to the USPTO. If there's a piece of prior art on January 1st, 2010, you would say then, or January 1st, 2000, you would say, oh, well, I invented that thing December 10th, 1999.
Aren't there currently fairly simple technologies that could have avoided that problem? Suppose the PTO says the only evidence we will accept is that you posted publicly a appropriately encrypted description of your invention, and you're going to give us the key now when you're claiming. That is, you can timestamp things, essentially. And it would seem to me if you can timestamp things and you say, we won't accept your handwritten note, which we have no way of knowing when was written, we will only accept time-stamped evidence, wouldn't that have solved the problem?
That would have solved the problem, but it would have probably eliminated some of the individuals. You know, you would think of an... The whole thing is, you would think of an invention, I mean, you could be in your garage, and, or you could be some small startup in your basement, and you would think of an invention, and then you would go from there and you would develop it. You wouldn't think that you had to go through all these formalities in order to... actually obtain the patent. And because you didn't go through your formalities, then you were then usurped from your patent and given.
Wouldn't be
else.
Much of a formality, but anyway.
Exactly. If everyone knew about it, it wouldn't be a formality. And it would have to become common knowledge among the entire general public. And then, I mean, kind of the funny thing is we're all studying intellectual property, and you tell people, I'm studying intellectual property, and I've gotten it 100 times. Well, what's that? I don't understand what intellectual property is. And if you say patents, copyrights, trademarks, and I've actually got somebody to ask me, well, what's a patent?
Yeah. But your last thing was foreign practice without publication, I think, wasn't it?
Yes. I went into that. I don't really know if the main reason behind the change with the foreign requirement was based on the TRIPS agreements. I mean, we could have signed the TRIPS agreements, and this change was more to bring us into effect with something that we signed in the TRIPS agreements. And as for what you said is... Because we're previously, when you were first to invent, if you had disclosed your invention and in first to file nations, you would automatically lose your rights because they were first to file and you disclosed. You couldn't do that. So it kind of created a big tension between somebody that invented something, wanted to disclose it, and they would lose all their rights in France, for example. Now, we still have that problem, though, so it didn't really feel like much of a justification. There is a 12-month grace period that's allowed for the first-to-file system. So if you disclose in America, you now have your rights intact. It's kind of like we retain some sort of a first-to-invent system, because if you disclose, you make a public disclosure as to your invention, they will give you 12 months to file your application, and you will still have rights over somebody else that files 3 days after your disclosure. So there is a slight... the retention of the first-to-invent system. The problem, though, is foreignly, once you disclose, you're out. And so the idea behind this whole first-to-file system is once you come up with the invention, you should, as quickly as possible, take it to the USPTO. You could file a provisional patent, for example. That would be fine to basically guarantee your rights if you file a provisional patent. And you could develop it further from there. They just didn't want you to have the ability to swear back and so on and so forth. Now, you still have the problem in other nations of the first to file is once you come up with it, and you tell somebody, you have to file in other nations. I believe if you file a provisional patent, it's considered okay until that provisional patent is published.
Do we have anything more before we go on to the next paper? People have any suggestions for our very well-organized speaker?
The paper's all where you really want. So I don't know if you really want to do it, but one thing that's interesting to me is kind of... how maybe the political costs shape how they, you know, restructure these things. So, for example, all the way from your first, where you look at the taxes, if you make it a significant transaction cost, or whether it's actually a private that's going to drive people nuts. And
yeah.
It's really politically impossible, you know, to tell that to people.
So what you were saying is if all of the... if all of the transaction costs basically drove people crazy, we would elect politicians that would then overrule that provision?
Right, or it just makes someone so unpopular.
But surely what would really happen if you're patenting that is it wouldn't be the individual taxpayer who would license it. It would be the firms that sell tax preparation services.
H&R Block would say, we can take advantage of this, and this.
And then you never are going to see the company.
Because there's only ones with the deep pockets to...
Or sufficiently organized. The individual taxpayer isn't going to do all that work, right? Maybe McIntax will do it for you at the individual level. But there'd be some middleman. All right, so now it's your turn. I've saved you 15 minutes.
Well, I talked for a long time.
Sorry. No, we have a whole...
Sorry, everybody.
It's quite all right. You didn't talk for a long time. You discussed for a long time. If you talked for a long time, I would shut you up.
Okay, so my paper is basically about derivative works and kind of the different roles you could formulate and, you know, what the various advantages and problems of different kind of roles are. So basically the structure is I just talk about, you know, the incentives for why you're wanting, you know, have copyright in the first place, and then later on just kind of different ways to do it. So let me just ask, are there any kind of like questions or insights that you wanted to bring up while you were reading, reading this paper?
One issue that occurred to me because of the Shakespeare example mm-hmm. is how would copyright cover the case where the original story actually happened? That is, Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. there really were Capulets and Montagues. I don't know if there was a real Romeo and Juliet or not. I'm pretty sure there was a real Macbeth, though I'm not certain. So suppose some historical events happen. I then write a play based on those historical events. To what extent is your play on those historical events a derivative work of mine, and to what extent is it a derivative work of the real history, which isn't under anybody's copyright?
So you said two different scenarios. One is where it comes directly from the history, and another where the history is written down into a body, and then somebody takes that body of work.
I'm thinking where someone does a work based on history, someone else does one.
Uh-huh.
How do we define whether or not the first one can limit the second one? Suppose the mm-hmm. characters really were named Romeo and Juliet, for example,
mm-hmm.
and you did a Romeo and Juliet play, and now Shakespeare does a Romeo and Juliet play.
Huh. I wonder if, I think there are some modern contemporary examples of that. So there's that one movie about George W. Bush that came out pretty recently, and I think his name is Oliver Stone, but... you know, obviously that's like really recent, not like his other film on JFK, which had a little bit more time. But in those cases, I'm not sure there's any action taken. Granted, it is politics, and we have a democratic culture, so it'd be kind of...
Well, Bush can't sue, because Bush doesn't have a copyright on his own acts.
Right.
But the question is, when somebody does the second Bush movie,
mm-hmm.
can the first Bush movie sue?
Oh.
The Romeo and Juliet case, I believe it is the case both that there were some historical events it was based on, though how close I don't know, and I am reasonably sure there had been a series of works of fiction in each of which the protagonist got younger for plot reasons, of which Shakespeare's is a famous one.
Copyrights on facts or historical events are considered very thin copyrights. You only have a copyright protection in your actual expression of how those facts occurred. Now, if you are reiterating exactly how they occurred because they exactly happened, you don't really have any protection. You wouldn't have. So with Romeo and Juliet and the Montagues, everybody, if it happened just that way and you had written it just that way, you wouldn't have any protection on...
But of course,
but
you aren't going to write it just that way, right? When you do a play based on historical events,
exactly.
you're structuring them, adding them, selecting, and so forth.
Exactly, and your expression of the addition and how you express those facts is yours in itself. However, someone else can still can take those same facts and express it in their own.
But the problem is that the boundary line between expression and idea is a very, very fuzzy boundary line. So suppose, for example, that I don't use any of your words, but suppose that in your plot you had the ending bit of Romeo and Juliet with the fake death, and then he thinks she's dead, and so he commits suicide, and then she commits suicide. And suppose that hadn't really happened in history. And I then do those same things in my second Romeo and Juliet. Well, I haven't stolen any of your lines, but I've stolen the elements of the plot that you added. Anyway, we've got another.
What I think don't get interesting is with, Sam like Saturday Night Live, for example, Will Ferrell does a George W. Bush character that, and lots of comedians on that show have done, big caricatures of historical people. Now the caricatures are sort of based upon historical facts and how people perceive them, but it is sort of expression. So, with that, I'm just sort of putting it forward, would that someone could copy that expression and at the same time argue that that expression was only a representation of people's perception of historical facts in the first place? That's where I think it would get hard to determine how thick or thin the copyright was.
It seems to me to be sort of set a law. So if you have an encyclopedia, and it expresses facts in a certain kind of way, and you just love that, it's going to be copyright infringement. But then the facts themselves are not copyrightable. And so I guess when you're taking a fictionalized version of history, for example, and you just take certain facts and you alter them, in what you choose or maybe what you add in, then it becomes an expression. So if you're going to take elements that maybe were added in from a work of historical fiction, that might infringe, I would say. If there aren't more questions, I have certain things I want to say in addition.
Yes.
So one thing that towards the end of the paper I started talking about the idea of exempting derivative works that are of a different medium or purpose than the original. So my model for this was Winnie the Pooh. So the author, I don't know how to say his name, pronounce his name, but Milne,
I think.
Milne? Okay, so Milne, from what I understand, these stuffed animals were already pre-existing, and he took inspiration from them and turned them into actual characters. So he breathed life into them through the written word. And, you know, that's not something that comes, it's probably affected by the look of the animals, but I would imagine that a lot of it just comes from him himself. And it kind of calls back the idea that an author's personality or personhood is kind of in his expressions. But with that, I also say, what if we exempt stuff like that? But then there, you have this problem with commercials with advertisement. So I give the example of, what if people just plastered Harry Potter when, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, all over the billboards, how sick people would be, and people who might get otherwise interested in it might say, oh, that's ridiculous, Harry Potter, because they already have a bad image of it. And I was thinking, how can you make a distinction? But then I kind of realized that you kind of make it you can make an art versus commercial distinction, maybe through the way that when we do First Amendment analysis, we make a difference between commercial speech, which is less protected than other forms of speech. We could carry over some of that analysis into separating, treating advertisements as being different from more artistic.
So what you're saying is that my copyright might be stronger against commercial uses than against artistic uses.
Right.
I was thinking, in Disney World, they created a whole ride and adventure land area based off of Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm assuming they sell stuff there, too. Would she be entitled then to get some portion of the sales from that or from the products that are sold there? Or?
Yeah, so I guess, in terms of when you're looking at how you can set the rules, you could have a limited protection. So I talk about, instead of 70 years, something like a derivative work like that might be, you could do that after 20 years maybe, or you could do that, or you could have some kind of other limitations. But I'm wondering also how, I guess that could be artistic. So let's say that goes into artistic. Then I guess under what I just said, with separating mediums, making exceptions for mediums, she would not be able to get anything from that. So that might, in an intuitive sense, be a problem.
So would you describe that as artistic or commercial? They've got a ride. Mm-hmm. The ride, after all, Harry Potter is commercial too. She makes money by her royalties.
Right.
So how do you define, what's the difference between artistic and commercial in the copyright context?
So some ideas and please add in if you have your own, but I'm wondering if there are certain traditional things that are considered to be artistic expressions, so things like books, paintings, and that sort of thing.
But wouldn't you describe Disneyland as an artistic expression?
It could be, but it's not traditionally conceived of as such.
Right now it is. It's been around for a long time.
As an art?
Disneyland has been around for a long time.
Sure, right.
And amusement parks have been around for a long time.
Right.
And if you think about an amusement park, there's certainly some sense in which it's an artistic expression, right? It's got, certain rides and conventions and stuff of that sort.
Right.
I'm not sure I know how you're going to draw the line. But anyway.
If anybody has an insight to how you can draw the line, maybe?
But take the more general issue, which he's really raising, which seems to be an interesting issue, which is where what ought to be covered under derivative works. And we've got the one extreme view, which says basically we shouldn't protect derivative works at all. The only thing we protect is something which is a direct competitor with the original, which is basically a copy of the original or a very close copy of the original. And then the opposite extreme, you could say anything which couldn't have had its present form if it weren't for the original works, the derivative work. And where in between? Opinions?
It's just such a gray area. Like, I don't even know if I can come up with an articulable answer.
How about translations? Is it clear that a translation should be covered?
I mean, it kind of depends on how closely related the two, in my mind, how closely related the two languages are. My best friend is, my old roommate is Palestinian, and her father would frequently try and translate Arabic for us. And you'd often say, like, oh, well, that's not really translatable. That's not really translatable as we were talking. And so when you have languages that really, it's really, really difficult to translate one between the other, I think that there should potentially be copyright protection if there really is some sort of artistic skill that's going through, or if, like, translation.
So there are two different questions here. One of them is, does the translation get a copyright? The other is, does the translation violate the copyright of the original?
I think it does violate the copyright, but I do think it should be given, it could potentially be given copyright protection in the aspects that are
skin. Is there any reason, this is one thing I found puzzling about the existing law, is there any reason why a derivative work shouldn't have its own copyright? Not why it should be allowed to be sold without the other person's permission, but isn't it unambiguously desirable that if I do a translation, I should be able to copyright the translation, then go to the original author and say, look, here's my translation. I would like you to license me the right to publish.
Kind of like patents that build our improvements on previous patents.
Yeah, same kind of issue.
I agree with that. I mean, that makes sense. You did all the work. It should be. But they said that copyright is not based on sweat and brow. It's based on expression. So
but there's expression, as she says. Any translation, you know, between
you're gonna have some
different
sort of
languages.
In there.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, that makes sense that you did all the work to make the entire...
But it has the further advantage that I think he discussed in his paper and we discussed a little in class, that it makes negotiations easier because it means that when you have done your translation, you can show it to the original author without being afraid that he'll steal it. Because he would be violating your copyright.
Some reasonable, just like your point was with how patents can build upon each other. Patents are actually granting rights, they just grant rights. They just grant restrictions.
But part of the problem in this is it seems to me there's an awful lot that's much more distant than a translation that's a derivative work. That you could argue that half the fantasy of the last 40 years is a derivative work from Tolkien. Right? Anything that has orcs in it, is, or hobbits. Orcs and hobbits as we know them are really inventions of Tolkien. So in that sense, they're all derivative works. But then, you know, it's very hard to know where you draw the line. You know, are half the modern mysteries derivative works from the 1930s, tough guy, you know, Hammett and Chandler stories, which, you know, the rule is when you don't know what to do next, have somebody come through a door with a gun in his hand. That was either Chandler or Hammett's description of the format. Well, people can think about it and can give more suggestions. If you people think of other ideas for his paper, you can mention them in our final class Tuesday, when I will try to sum up everything we've done for the whole semester and take all of your comments and suggestions.
I would like all the little things that I gave you guys so that I can have your comments and make sure that
right.
Whatever you guys wrote down.
Uh-huh.